A Russian paramilitary group warns Ukraine to get out of Bakhmut after a bloody months-long offensive.
The Wagner chief claims that the forces left in Bakhmut consist of elderly people and teenagers, urging Zelensky to pull them back to prevent them from being slaughtered.
Plus, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urges the U.N. Human Rights Council to hold Russia accountable for violations of war crimes and international humanitarian laws.
Governments that commit atrocities abroad are also likely to violate the rights of people at home. And that's exactly what Russia is doing.
And later in the program, as the war drags on, dreams of a college degree are on hold for thousands of Africans forced to leave their studies in Ukraine. Today is Friday, March 3rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden will welcome German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to the White House today for discussions on continued support for Ukraine and also bilateral cooperation on a range of global security and economic issues. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby on Thursday told reporters that discussing additional support for Ukraine is high on the agenda for today's meeting and that the United States would be announcing a new package of military aid for Ukraine later in the day. Meanwhile, the Wagner Group is urging Ukraine to get out of Bakhmut. From the Associated Press, Charles de Ledesma has details.
Shevgeny Prigozhin, the owner of the Wagner Group military company, has released a video urging Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to withdraw the remaining forces from Bakhmut to save their lives. Clad in military fatigues, Prigozhin charged that Bakhmut has been effectively encircled, leaving just one road that Ukrainian troops can use. The Wagner chief claims that the forces left in Bakhmut consist of elderly people and teenagers, urging Zelensky to pull them back to prevent them from being slaughtered. Following the statement, an elderly man and two young men, purportedly captured Ukrainian soldiers, were shown to make the plea to Zelensky. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
So just how is this sort of threat influencing the Ukrainian military in this key city? I spoke earlier with Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv.
What are you hearing about a possible decision that Ukraine will actually pull back from Bakhmut at this point and cut their losses?
So at this point of time, what we're hearing from Ukrainian official sources, from Ukrainian President Zelensky, from the general staff, from military officials, it doesn't look like that Ukrainians have already decided on anything like that. So for the moment, we don't have any confirmation that Ukrainian side even thinking about this. It's something that, of course, is difficult for us to predict. But according to the official sources, Ukrainian forces continue to keep the defense of the city of Bakhmut. At the same time, in parallel, there is this new report by the Institute for the Study of War. And the experts from the Institute for the Study of War also mentioned that Russian forces appear to have temporarily scaled back efforts to encircle Bakhmut from the southwest as well as from the northwest, and may instead be focusing on pressuring Ukrainian forces to withdraw from the city. So at the beginning, we were talking about the fact that Russian forces use a lot of pressure and a lot of manpower and most of their forces in that area to actually encircle the city and enable Ukrainian forces of any actions. As of now, situation is kind of changing. And Ukrainian forces report that very heavy battles are happening, but Ukrainian keep their positions strong. We also hear from the military, who is currently located in that area, that actually the fightings are now happening at the outskirts of the city as well, and still a certain number of civilians remain in the city. But we have to realize that the city of Bakhmut is currently a front line itself. So situation is extremely difficult. However, according to all this international analysis and official reports that we get from the Ukrainian authorities, we can see that for both sides, it's extremely difficult to take the whole control of the city of Bakhmut in terms of administratively, Ukrainian forces keep the control of the city. And the city of Bakhmut is very important for both sides as well, because, of course, for Russian forces, again, from international experts, that Russia has this goal goal to take control of the Donetsk region and Luhansk region in full by the end of March, of course, the city of Bakhmut is a must for Russian forces. So I think that we will see certain changes sometime soon in the situation in there. But for the moment, both sides continue to engage in very heavy fightings, and none of the sides is preparing to withdraw.
The paramilitary Russian Wagner Group has been sending out some stark messages that Ukraine needs to get out, or else, basically, it's going to be even more deadly and more dangerous. Are you hearing anything, or is President Zelensky addressing that warning and threat?
Here in Ukraine, we do hear this, of course, as well. But this is considered here in Ukraine as kind of a tactic that Wagner Group is using. And Ukrainian general staff particularly reports that Wagner Group have enormous losses in the area of Bakhmut. So for Wagner Group, it could be kind of a tactical, you know, decision to trying to use such informational pressure to make it easier for them, because they're also lacking resources and lacking manpower. So it's not really particularly a special reaction or any like official separate reaction on this kind of informational pressure. And this kind of pressure from Wagner Group would definitely not change the decision of the Ukrainian forces on the defense of the city. What can change the decision is operational status, but not this informational pressure.
Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said today, after meeting with his counterparts from India, Japan, and Australia, that Russia cannot be allowed to wage war with impunity. The members of this so-called Quad group at the G20 also issued a statement saying Russia's threat of using nuclear weapons is unacceptable. In a video addressed Thursday to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Blinken noted the Council's Commission of Independent International Inquiry on Ukraine, or COI, and how it's played a crucial role in shining a spotlight on Moscow's ongoing abuses.
The COI's first report in October concluded that Russia has committed war crimes and violations of international humanitarian law. As long as Russia continues to wage its war, the COI should continue to document such abuses, providing an impartial record of what's occurring and a foundation for national and international efforts to hold perpetrators accountable.
I spoke with Lisa Schlein in Geneva to get more details on the start of what will be a six-week session. Secretary Blinken really put out a strong message, stressing the need for the Council to extend high-level war crimes investigation into Russia's actions in Ukraine.
He did stress the need for having some kind of an international tribunal in order to investigate and hold Russia accountable. But he said that governments commit atrocities abroad, also likely to violate the rights of people at home. And so he noted that the Russian government was holding more than 500 political prisoners in Russia and had closed all human rights organizations and muzzled the independent press in the country. So his message was that not only was Russia to be held accountable for the crimes, alleged crimes, that it has committed in Ukraine, but also for the abuse and violations against its own population in Russia.
And we also understand that Russia's deputy foreign minister spoke. I'm curious as to what he had to say. And given that Russia was suspended from the Council over the invasion in April, they can still take part as an observer, but they're still allowed to give speeches.
This is the first time that a Russian high-level minister, in this case the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, did appear before the Council in person since the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. When he got up to speak, a few of the delegations left the room. It was a far cry from what happened last year when Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov spoke to the Council. He was obliged to speak remotely because he was barred from entering, from flying into Geneva because of sanctions that were put upon Russia by the European Union. However, it was a very dramatic affair, though he spoke remotely. Once he began, the delegates that were in the Council, about 100 of them, all got up in unison and they all walked out. Lavrov didn't see this, but the rest of the world did, and it was very very dramatic display of criticism of what Russia had done in terms of its aggression on Ukraine. The situation this time was different. The minister was able to speak to a fairly large group of people, although there were criticisms from a number of the delegates. You mentioned that Russia has been suspended by the General Assembly from being a member of the Human Rights Council, and that is correct. However, it is actively participating in the work of the Council as an observer. It is allowed to do that. There are no rules against that at all. And in fact, what's rather interesting is that Ryabkov, the deputy foreign minister, seemed to be pretty cocky about the fact that Russia was actually participating actively in the council and that it was planning to run for election in the fall to become a member of the council again. So he seemed to indicate that he wasn't at all upset that Russia had been suspended from the council. He said that the work of Russia was very important and it was important that it be there. So what I found most disturbing, I think, was that the deputy foreign minister essentially accused the Kyiv regime of systematically trampling on the fundamental human rights and freedoms of millions of its people, those primarily who are native language speakers of Russia. And that is the excuse that Russia itself used in 2014 when it backed the separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk, who began the war against the Ukrainian government at that time in 2014. He also brought up the spurious claim that Ukraine was being run by Nazis and used this as a justification for Russia's so-called military operation in Ukraine. And he mentioned that neo-Nazi groups were operating openly in Ukraine.
Lisa Schlein reporting to us from Geneva. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. The European Union has marked the anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine with more sanctions against Moscow. Previous packages have targeted commodities like oil, gas, coal, steel, cigarettes, vodka, and even gold. But one key Russian export is expected to be off the EU's list once again: diamonds. For VOA, Lisa Bryant went to the world's diamond trading capital of Antwerp, Belgium, to find out why.
This historic city seems far away from the battlefields in Ukraine, but it's linked to the conflict through Russian diamonds. Nearly all rough diamonds imported into the European Union arrive here. A quarter or more usually come from Russia. Ukraine has long pushed for sanctioning Russian diamonds, which it says help finance Moscow's war machine. In the crosshairs is diamond powerhouse Alrosa, partly owned by the Russian government. Last year, Washington and London put sanctions on Russian diamond imports, but not the EU. Some lawmakers are pushing to change that. That includes Kathleen Van Brempt, a Belgium European Parliament member from Antwerp.
The Antwerp diamond sector used to be a front runner in getting rid of the blood diamonds. It's very important that the Antwerp diamond sector remains a front runner in getting rid of these diamonds, because Russian diamonds are also blood diamonds.
But Antwerp's diamond industry argues that sanctioning Russian diamonds could cost thousands of jobs, and it would simply export the problem. Tom Nays is spokesperson for the Antwerp World Diamond Center.
If they don't get sold here, they will get sold somewhere else. And they will get sold in trade hubs where you do not have the regulations against anti-money laundering, where you do not have the regulations against the financing of terrorism, which we have the strictest in the world here right in Antwerp.
Antwerp's mayor also opposes banning Russian diamond imports. His office did not respond to VOA interview requests. But there's one area where politicians and Antwerp's industry appear to agree: establishing an international system to trace and track Russian diamonds across borders. Reports say the EU and the Group of Seven Nations are discussing how that could work. Philippe Regnier, director of the International Peace Information Service Research Group, believes it's doable, but there are caveats.
We think it's possible, but it will require a lot of coordination and a lot of technical thinking. And the question is, who would be on board? How inclusive it would be? Because there's a big risk, of course, that big diamond players would not want to be part of that.
Van Brempt's office has been tracking Russian diamond exports and the ways Moscow appears to be circumventing U.S. sanctions and those of other nations. But the lawmaker still believes EU sanctions are important, along with the foolproof tracking system, to keep Antwerp's reputation as an ethical diamond center intact. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Antwerp, Belgium.
As Russian tanks rolled into eastern Ukraine a year ago, millions of Ukrainians fled to Poland. Many came by foot through the Medyka border crossing, where aid agencies mounted a huge emergency response. 12 months on, VOA's Henry Ridgewell returned to Medyka to see what has changed and how authorities are preparing for a possible new wave of refugees.
Daniil's short life has been turned upside down by Russia's invasion. He and his mother, Julia, fled Kyiv a year ago. They stayed in Dnipro, but were forced to flee again as the city came under attack and have just arrived at the Polish border town of Medyka. Now they have a new plan. Julia's new partner is a truck driver. They will live with him in the truck as he drives around Europe.
It's not so bad because it's very warm and we have light, electricity, and it's very interesting for my son. I have 3 years old son, and it's not so bad. It's really safety for us.
Polina Osadcha helps look after Daniil. Osadcha is a refugee who now works for the United Nations at this reception center at the Medyka border crossing. She says Ukrainians are adapting to the war.
They already, even when there was these problems with blackouts, for the first time all the people were stressed, shocked what to do, but now they have generators, they have power banks.
Britain's Mo Hornick and Mikey Stewart Richardson are from the MAD Foundation charity, which takes aid into Ukraine and refugees back to Britain. But today they have a feline passenger. Mo Hornick explains.
This little guy's owner has been living in the UK for a little while and was really desperate to be reunited with his mum. So we have helped organise some transport. It's more important than ever, almost, that people remain aware of the situation in Ukraine. I think a lot of people may feel a little bit fatigued by the news that they see, but the situation is still very, very desperate.
At the Medyka crossing, much has changed in a year. At the start of Russia's invasion, up to 30,000 refugees poured across this frontier every day. Now only a few hundred cross the border daily. Soup kitchens have been replaced with cell phone stalls. Buses quickly take the Ukrainians away from the border. The mayor of Przemyśl city, a few kilometres from the frontier, recalls the chaos of a year ago. Wojtek Bakun, the mayor of Przemyśl city, a few kilometres from the frontier, recalls the chaos of a year ago.
40% of all refugees from Ukraine crossing city of Przemyśl. So it's a huge amount of people crossing such a small city. A lot of them was very hungry, thirsty, you know, some of them need some medical assistance, medical help.
A former supermarket in Przemyśl has been turned into a humanitarian hub. The warehouse stores huge volumes of food and drink, medical supplies, beds and blankets. There are fears that a renewed Russian offensive will create a new wave of refugees. Again, Mayor Wojtek Bakun.
We have all that logistics system ready to expand. We have still a lot of beds stored in schools, things like that. So we're ready for that situation again. But hopefully that situation will not happen again.
Russia's invasion brought millions of refugees to Poland and large-scale land warfare to NATO's doorstep. 12 months on, with little sign of an end to the conflict, all sides are preparing for a long war. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News on the Poland-Ukraine border.
And finally today, Nigerians made up the largest number of sub-Saharan African students in Ukraine when Russia invaded a year ago, forcing thousands to flee and halting their education. Despite the ongoing war, universities in Ukraine and Nigeria teamed up last year to help these students complete their degrees. Timothy Obiju reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigerian medical student Abigail Theophilus gets emotional when she looks at the selfies she took with her classmates at Ukraine's Sumy State University last year, the day before Russia invaded.
That morning, I went to get an X-ray done, and I went into town. Everywhere was empty. People were lining up to get food, and at first, the threat of war was like, it was a regular thing in Eastern Europe to hear about war, but this was serious. So I went out, people had left, everyone was scanty.
Ukraine says there were about 76,000 foreign students studying in the country, more than 4,000 of them Nigerians, when Russia attacked. Egyptians and Moroccans were among the largest groups from Africa, which accounted for about a quarter of the total foreign students who mostly fled on their own. About 1,800 Nigerians were evacuated weeks into the war. Theophilus said they took a bus and later a train to reach Lviv and escape the fighting.
In Sumy State, it was difficult for anybody to leave. So the day I realized I needed to leave was when, I think it was during the evening time, there was a missile that was sent to one of their powerhouses, and I saw it pass. And I've never seen a missile before. And I saw it pass. The explosion happened, and it was night. Everywhere looked as bright as day. And it dawned on me that this was actually war.
Safely back in Nigeria, their studies were put on hold until October last year, when a deal between Ukrainian and Nigerian universities let students continue pursuing their degrees. Igbinedion University is one of the Nigerian schools enrolling students who left Ukraine. But the interruption in studies was a big setback, says Kofowurola Adewale, who enrolled months ago.
I wouldn't say that it's a great experience to have this big change in my life, but I'm just grateful that I did start university. That's in spite of the fact that, you know, the Nigerian university and the Nigerian system itself took me like 2 years back. I'm supposed to graduate like next year, but unfortunately now I'm supposed to graduate in like 3.5 years time, which is like a big change for me.
Igbinedion University did not respond to requests for comment on the program. Nigerian students are used to education disruptions from periodic teacher strikes that can sometimes last for months. And not all foreign students chose to flee Ukraine despite the ongoing fighting. Nigerian medical student Elijah Kamani stayed in Vinnytsia, a town in west-central Ukraine, southwest of Kyiv, that has not yet been hit by the war.
As the summer arrived, a lot of tourists and other people began to come back. I don't know, but the city was still, it was vibrant, it had life in it. So I didn't see the need to leave at that point also. So I stayed during the summer and enjoyed it as normal people would. Even though there were threats up and down, we had air alarms and we had to go to bunkers.
Both the foreign students who remained in Ukraine and those that fled can only hope that the war ends as soon as possible. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that'll do it for us today, but stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.